This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Kim Landers. On the program today, political test. Will bushfires and the pandemic sway voters going to the polls in a crucial federal by-election? And with teens spending more time online during the pandemic, new research examines what it's doing to their minds.
I do realise that it can absorb a lot of time. Yeah, a couple of my friends have quite a couple hundred hours on certain video games. That's definitely peaked, in current events.
It's a nervous time for health authorities after Victoria's coronavirus outbreak spread to Sydney and Darwin. In Sydney, residents of the inner west suburb of Balmain have been put on alert after a worker at a grocery store tested positive for COVID-19 not long after leaving hotel quarantine in Melbourne. While locals are concerned and confused, one epidemiologist still believes it's unlikely we'll see a repeat of the community transmission that's occurring in the Melbourne suburbs. Rhett Burney reports.
Thursday night training at the Balmain Junior Rugby Club was almost back to normal, but just a few hours before kickoff, 120 youngsters were told to stay home.
Been training for 4 to 6 weeks in a non-contact set of rules, and this week we had permission to go to full contact and regular rugby, so it was a tough call.
That's the club's president, Paul Timbrell. He says news a Balmain Woolworths worker had tested positive to COVID-19 after working two shifts at the store left him with no choice but to err on the side of caution and cancel training.
Yeah, if in doubt, play the more conservative option, it seemed best way to go. And I didn't necessarily have a whole lot of time to get a lot of input, so for now, that seemed the best approach.
Health authorities say the Woolworths worker had returned home from overseas, landing in Melbourne. He tested positive for the virus there and was placed in hotel quarantine for 14 days before being given the all clear and heading home to Sydney. Fiona Dury shops at the Balmain Woolworths store, and she admits the news was a bit unnerving.
I must say I was really shocked, actually. It is quite a confined store, is the thing. It's quite cramped, so it is hard to socially distance in there. But I'm sure that the team in there will do their best. And I know that a lot of people in the local community are pretty sensible.
Woolworths says the store has been cleaned and 50 staff have been placed into isolation. A Darwin man who also underwent and cleared 2 weeks in hotel quarantine in Melbourne before spending time with family in one of the city's hotspots and then heading back to the Northern Territory has also tested positive. But authorities there say the risk of him spreading the disease is low. Peter Collingon is an epidemiologist at the Australian National University.
As far as I'm aware, these two cases were in quarantine and these were very late detections. And the virus in people who've got it can persist for quite a while, even though it may not be viable and cause infection.
Professor Collingon says South Korean research recently found some people can test positive for up to 6 weeks after their initial diagnosis, but won't be infectious.
So at the moment, yes, the virus is probably there, but it may not be viable. And the infectivity of these people, if it's present at all, is very low.
But he insists that's no reason for people to be complacent and that Melbourne's suburban outbreaks demonstrate why everyone should keep a safe distance and wash their hands frequently.
Rhett Burney reporting. Well, as Victoria tries to contain the coronavirus outbreaks in Melbourne, other states are chipping in to help. Airports in other capital cities are taking travellers returning from overseas, and even the AFL is looking at an exodus from the troubled city, with discussions underway about moving clubs interstate. Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
For AFL fans in this Perth pub, bringing more clubs over to play in WA is a no-brainer.
Look, if they want to come to Western Australia and they get picked up at the airport and quarantined for 2 weeks, not a problem. It's good for WA. Win-win for us, you know?
Deciding where clubs can play is complicated at the moment. The AFL is accommodating border restrictions and trying to keep players away from the community. Most clubs are still playing in Melbourne, where the spike in COVID-19 cases has caused major upheaval. It's now expected they'll shift interstate. Western Australia's Police Commissioner Chris Dawson says he's in discussions with the AFL about taking extra clubs, and he's happy to make it work as long as the players stick to quarantine rules.
We'd like to make sure that if that does occur, we do it without compromising public safety. So that's what we're all working towards.
Four teams are set to play in WA in the next fortnight in front of what will be the largest crowds Australia's had in months. By then, restrictions will have eased to the point that 60,000 people will be allowed to watch the game between the home sides, Fremantle and West Coast. Fans at the pub say that's a pretty good sweetener to attract more teams out west.
Yeah, most definitely. I think, like, by having all the teams here, we give opportunity for all the supporters to go watch. Far better for the AFL game because at the moment there's empty stands, so... yeah, we can get along. Let's do it.
I reckon it's a good argument for WA. We've got a good stadium and why not? We're doing so well, so...
The Victorian outbreak has already seen the NRL's Melbourne Storm shift away from Melbourne to the Sunshine Coast, where the club's likely to play out the season. And it's not just sporting teams. The federal government is redirecting international flights away from Melbourne to help ease the burden on Victoria by accommodating travellers in hotel quarantine in other states. While New South Wales has been reluctant to take on the extra load, Queensland, South Australia and WA have indicated they can assist.
I think now it's really a time that we all work this on this together, and I think it is very fair from the other states to take on these other travellers.
Michaela Lucas is a clinical immunologist at Sir Charles Gairdner Hospital in Perth. While an inquiry is underway in Victoria into the link between COVID-19 clusters and hotel quarantine, she doesn't think other states should be concerned.
We can be reassured to some extent that many travellers have already returned very safely without us seeing here really any community transmission in any of these other states.
As for the football crowds expected later this month, she says Western Australia should be pretty safe.
There's enough evidence now to say that at this current stage, we haven't seen community transmission. And if there is no community transmission, it means there should be no undetected virus within the community. So even if you bring crowds together, it is a calculable risk.
Footy fans back at the pub say that's as good a reason as any to head along.
There hasn't been any community transition as far as I've seen in a very long time in WA, so I imagine it should be fine.
I wouldn't be too worried about it. Obviously, it's, 50% capacity, so there'll still be distancing between seats anyway. But, yeah, not so much because I think we've got such little community transmission that we're with us.
Bridget Fitzgerald with that report. Well, it's one of the most unusual environments for a political contest, but after bushfires and now a pandemic, many voters in the New South Wales federal seat of Eden Monaro say they just want certainty. After enduring so much, they're voting tomorrow in a by-election for a seat which spans from the south coast of New South Wales to the highest peak in Australia and right around the nation's capital. And it's held by Labor on a margin of less than 1%. Tom Lowry reports.
This weekend should be one of the busiest for Mick Klima's ski hire shop in Cooma, about an hour's drive north of the New South Wales snowfields. But instead, it's just about empty.
Yeah, never seen it this quiet. It's good in a way, but it's not good in other ways. Yeah, hopefully it will pick up, hopefully.
The ski industry has been taking a massive hit due to coronavirus, with resorts reducing capacity to comply with social distancing. Worse still, there's been hardly any snow falling so far this winter. Just about no one is hiring or buying skis right now.
In this industry, it'll probably take 2 to 3 years to get back to normal, back to get on track, you know. It's just not now. You've got to get through this part, but it's what I see down the track, which makes it just as difficult.
For businesses like Mick Klima's, the JobKeeper scheme has been a lifeline. Turnover might be down 70%, but his shop is fully staffed, with 150 employees running the 24-hour, 7-day-a-week operation to kit out the small numbers of tourists still bound for the slopes.
It's a great help, you know. The government's done a bloody good job.
JobKeeper's an issue both major parties are keen to discuss as they head into Saturday's Eden Monaro by-election. Here's Liberal candidate Fiona Kotvoyes.
What I've heard from people is how important JobKeeper has been. It's meant that businesses have been able to keep staff on. It's meant they've been able to keep their doors open.
But on local TV, Labor tells a different story.
If you think the Liberals should keep their promise and not take JobKeeper away from struggling local businesses so soon, the by-election is your chance to tell them so.
The financial package is due to end in September, with the government indicating there could be targeted support after that. Labor's candidate for the seat, Christy McBain, says businesses need more certainty.
They're not seeing a plan for what's going to happen after September. You know, snapping back after September is going to literally break the back of some of our small businesses.
Jeremy Maher is one of those grappling with what the next few months might bring. He's just bought a cafe in Cooma and admits it's been an unusual time to invest in a new business.
I guess you'd probably think so, but it's also probably worse to try to find a job. So figured just buy myself a job.
And when he goes into the polling booth on Saturday, he'll be thinking about which party's got a plan to lift the region's economy.
My mind is, I guess, stimulus beyond the end of September.
Labor's Christy McBain wants JobKeeper extended in regions like hers that have been doing it tough.
We actually need to start prioritising the regions that are hurting the most. And one of the regions that is hurting the most is Eden Monaro.
The opposition is also criticising the government for not releasing a Treasury review into JobKeeper until after tomorrow's by-election. Liberal candidate Fiona Kotvoyes says it will be detailed in good time.
The findings from the review will come out and other support will be provided to the specific industries where it's needed. And that's what we need. We need to get back on our feet as quickly as possible.
And with that goal firmly in mind, ski shop owner Mick Klemer compares the current situation to a particularly tough football game.
You're losing, but you just got to dig in and, you know, hoping that, you know, you're going to kick a goal. And don't panic and just stick with it.
Cooma ski shop owner Mick Klemer ending that report from Tom Lowry. You're listening to AM and it's 11 minutes past 8. Equality in health, education, jobs and life expectancy between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians remains elusive, if not getting worse, despite a decade of trying to close the gap. Now there's to be a new approach that's expected to be agreed upon today at a virtual meeting between Indigenous leaders and state and federal ministers. Here's political reporter Tom Eagledon.
There's little to show for a decade of closing the gap targets, and Indigenous leaders are beyond frustrated.
It's a very important meeting because we are now getting towards the end of 18 months of hard negotiations.
That's Gudandji Arrernte woman Pat Turner, who heads a coalition of peak Indigenous community groups and will co-chair today's meeting. She's been arguing it's time for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to determine their futures for themselves.
The days are over when the bureaucrats come out and tell us, you know, we've got a program for you, and as long as you meet these guidelines, when really what they should be doing is listening to our people and acting on that, because we believe that our people are in the best position to know what the local priorities are and how they should best be responded to by government.
And that means four key reform areas will be agreed on to give Indigenous groups a greater say. First, decision-making will be equal between government officials and Indigenous community groups. Secondly, those groups will be strengthened.
And we've got sectors that need to be built up, like the early childhood sector, education, housing, and so on. We've got a reasonably strong health sector, but we're still not funded on a needs basis.
Third, data will be shared between governments and community groups to allow for better partnerships.
And they get rid of the systemic and the institutionalised racism in their systems that our people are still subject to. And
Can you give me an example of that?
Look at hospitals, for example. Aboriginal people do not get the same level of treatment in hospitals as other Australians.
What hasn't been agreed on is money. Pat Turner says without more investment from state and federal governments, more failure is likely.
If we can have $240 billion over the next 10 years for the Defence Force, surely we can have a few billion of that to close the gap.
How many billion will it take, Pat Turner?
Well, I think it'll take 10 to 15 billion.
Is that something you think the government's open to?
Well, I haven't got a clue. They haven't been prepared to discuss budgets.
And there's still a way to go on the fine details of the targets themselves. Ken Wyatt is the Minister for Indigenous Australians, and he spoke with Radio National Breakfast this morning.
We've worked with 51 Aboriginal peak organisations to have their input into what the target should be, what are the components and elements of those targets, and how we hold all of us now accountable in a way that we've not done. There's a great deal of enthusiasm and commitment from ministers for Aboriginal Affairs. And in our ongoing discussions with my co-chair, Pat Turner, we've found the enthusiasm to be refreshing, but also the commitment to working with Aboriginal people, not doing things to them.
The Minister for Indigenous Australians, Ken Wyatt, ending Tom Eagledon's report. The ABC says it's disappointing and disturbing that the Australian Federal Police has asked prosecutors to consider laying charges over stories about possible war crimes. The AFP confirmed yesterday it had sent a brief of evidence to the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions, which will now weigh up whether to charge ABC journalist Dan Oakes for publishing classified information. Rachel Mealy reports.
The ABC published a series of stories in 2017 known as the Afghan Files. They were written by Dan Oakes and Sam Clark and based on leaked classified information. The stories alleged Australian soldiers had committed war crimes in Afghanistan.
Tonight, we reveal serious allegations that Australian soldiers may have committed unlawful killings during Australia's longest war and claims that the death of an unarmed Afghan civilian was covered up.
The stories were the subject of a federal police investigation which began in 2017 and culminated in raids on the ABC's Ultimo headquarters last year.
Welcome. Right now, Australian federal police are still conducting their day-long raid here at the ABC headquarters in Sydney.
While both journalists were the subject of the investigation, the ABC has confirmed that the brief of evidence relating to the leak relates only to Dan Oakes. Last night, he tweeted this response.
Would just like to point out at this moment that whether or not we are ever charged or convicted over our stories, the most important thing is that those who broke our laws and the laws of armed conflict are held to account. Our nation should be better.
ABC Managing Director David Anderson called the news a disappointing and disturbing development. News Director Gavin Morris says the accuracy of the reports has never been challenged.
Look, I think this is a really distressing development in the saga that's now gone on for 3 years over an excellent piece of journalism that hasn't never been challenged in relation to the truth of it. Here we are 3 years on, the process has moved forward and we still have two journalists whose lives and careers are in limbo.
What information has the ABC been given about the possible charges?
Well, very little. I mean, we've been given no information really about the brief that's been sent on. We've got given some vague information about the intention of it, but we are now waiting, like Dan and Sam are, for some sort of official word on what exactly is being pursued here.
Peter Grester is the director of the Alliance for Journalist Freedom.
I absolutely believe there's need for greater legal protection. We don't have anything in our laws or in our constitution that guarantees press freedom. In a way, it's hard for me to criticise the Australian Federal Police because they are acting in accordance with the law. But the law allows this kind of prosecution to take place. Now, there is always going to be some discretion in the policing system, in the prosecution system, and I urge the authorities to exercise that discretion. But the fact is that there is no, without legal protections, we're going to see more and more of these kinds of prosecutions.
Government Minister Simon Birmingham was asked whether he was comfortable with the Federal Police referring the matter to the Commonwealth Director of Public Prosecutions.
The Attorney-General under our government has taken action to ensure there are additional safeguards there for journalists, for the freedom of the press, and that he's outlined very clearly the very cautious way in which he will act to make sure that that is protected into the future.
Even if the CDPP recommends charges, the final decision rests with Attorney General Christian Porter. Shadow Attorney General Mark Dreyfus has called on him to immediately rule out the prosecution of Dan Oakes. A spokesman for Mr. Porter declined to comment.
Rachel Mealy reporting. In the United States, there's been a major development in the investigation involving now-deceased sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. The disgraced financier's former girlfriend and long-term associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, has been arrested for her involvement in grooming girls for abuse, a development victims have welcomed. This report from North America correspondent James Glenday.
This was a moment several women had waited for years.
Maxwell was among Epstein's closest associates.
and helped him exploit girls who were as young as 14 years old.
The announcement of charges against Ghislaine Maxwell, who has repeatedly been accused of orchestrating a scheme to please convicted paedophile Jeffrey Epstein.
Maxwell played a critical role in helping Epstein to identify, befriend and groom minor victims for abuse.
Acting U.S. Attorney Audrey Strauss says Ms. Maxwell did that by taking an interest in vulnerable girls, treating them to gifts or encouraging them to accept offers of travel or education from Epstein. Once the girls felt indebted or a relationship had been developed, Ms. Maxwell then is accused of trying to normalise sexual behaviour before encouraging encounters like massages that led to the abuse.
Maxwell's presence as an adult woman helped put the victims at ease. As Maxwell and Epstein intended, this grooming process left the minor victims susceptible to sexual abuse.
There have been numerous allegations made against Ms. Maxwell over a period of several years. Some victims said she controlled the girls and effectively ran the operation, but she's always denied any wrongdoing. The British socialite is said to have connected Epstein to many of her powerful friends, including people like Bill Clinton and Prince Andrew. Four of the six charges she's facing relate to a period between 1994 and 1997. The other two are allegations of perjury in 2016. William Sweeney Jr. from the FBI says she's been closely watched for some time.
We've been discreetly keeping tabs on Maxwell's whereabouts as we work this investigation. And more recently, we learned she had slithered away to a gorgeous property in New Hampshire, continuing to live a life of privilege while her victims live with the trauma inflicted upon them years ago. We moved when we were ready, and Ms. Maxwell was arrested without incident. Like Epstein, Ms. Maxwell chose to blatantly disregard the law and her responsibility as an adult, using whatever means she had at her disposal to lure vulnerable youth into behavior they should never have been exposed and which creates lasting harm.
The arrest has been welcomed by some of the alleged victims who were worried justice would not be done after Epstein hanged himself in a jail cell last year while awaiting trial on sex trafficking charges. Lawyers representing several women say they hope investigators will continue to target anyone else involved in the scheme. In Washington, this is James Glenday reporting for AM.
Five police officers in India have been charged over the deaths of two shopkeepers who were allegedly tortured and sexually assaulted. The case in the country's south is being used by activists to challenge apathy towards police brutality. And a warning, this story by South Asia correspondent James Oten contains some distressing details.
Shop owners P. Jayaraj and his son J. Benix were taken into custody for a minor offence, keeping a shop open for 15 minutes after lockdown curfew. 4 days later, the father and son were dead after allegedly being beaten, tortured and sexually assaulted by police.
See, this was done by four authorities: police officials, medical officers, judicial magistrate and jail authority.
That's one of the lawyers representing the family, PM Vishnu Vartanen.
If any of them have done their respective jobs in time, and under law, could have saved this two lives.
Neighbours could hear the men cry out for help as they were allegedly assaulted and tortured in custody. The pair were so bloodied and bruised the day after that friends gave them a change of clothes. Both complained of severe rectum pain and bleeding. Despite this, lawyers say a magistrate did not ask them about their injuries and sent them to jail. They died 3 days later. There was outcry among town locals in the southern state of Tamil Nadu. But with the Black Lives Matter movement taking hold across the world, this case has now gained national prominence in India.
I think police torture has become quite routine, and therefore there is a level of acceptance as well.
That's Jayashree Bajoria, a senior researcher with Human Rights Watch.
In the case of US, where you see structural inequalities and racism that work when it comes to use of excessive force or disproportionate force, I should say, against brown and black people. In India, you see similar structural inequalities based on caste or based on religion, even on gender, I would say.
One Indian-based not-for-profit has reported that there were 27 deaths in the first week of India's lockdown due to police brutality. It's also reported that, on average, there were five deaths in custody every day last year. Jayashree Bajoria says beatings are often seen as a quick form of justice in a slow judicial system where the police culture traces back to British colonial rule.
The way the police were structured was to carry out the orders of the colonial rulers over its subjects. And unfortunately, even in independent India, to a large extent, that has not changed.
Activists are calling for a major overhaul of the country's policing system, starting with India ratifying the UN Convention Against Torture. This is James Oten reporting for AM.
Trying to prise a teenager away from their smartphone or laptop is hard at the best of times, but the coronavirus pandemic has only been increasing the amount of time young people are online. Now, an Australian study aims to dispel the idea that some teens are more predisposed than others to compulsive internet use. It warns any teens at risk of addiction, and limiting time spent online could be the only answer. Gavin Coote reports.
Like many 13-year-olds, Hugh Smith has been spending even more time than usual in his darkened bedroom surfing the internet in recent months.
Seeing as though like, we've been staying home, I mean, a lot of it was online learning, but there was also a lot of time where I'm just like home by myself and I can't really do much, so I'll just like watch YouTube, I guess.
It's a world of endless intrigue on the web, but the Year 8 student is well aware this too has its dangers.
I do realise that it can absorb a lot of time, and it's there are definitely alternatives that I could be doing, like going out on my trampoline or walking my dog, which would be a bit more healthier.
Now, Australian researchers have found a clear link between internet addiction in teenagers and emotion issues. In the first study of its kind, the team observed almost 3,000 teenagers over 4 years of their high schooling, from years 8 to 11. James Donald from the University of Sydney Business School is the lead author.
We know that young people, teenagers, are engaged online at rates we've never seen before, but we don't really know a lot about what the impacts are of high and at times unhealthy levels of internet use to a point where it becomes something that you might call addiction.
James Donald was keen to find out just what kind of effect this online behaviour was having on a young person's ability to control their emotions.
It might be that young people have certain, you might call, vulnerabilities around difficulties regulating their emotions in general, maybe, you know, trouble with impulses, maybe things like having trouble really focusing on challenging goals and tasks.
But the study aims to bust that myth. Co-author Joseph Cherokee from the Australian Catholic University says there's no clear evidence that teenagers with pre-existing emotional regulation issues are more susceptible to internet addiction.
People need to know that even if a kid's got a fantastic background, family is happy, engaged, like it can happen to them. It can happen to anybody. We weren't finding some young people were more susceptible than others. So it can happen to anybody. The second thing is that it's very easy for young people to fall into this because the internet is such an essential part of their life, their education, and of their future career. So there's no ability for us just to remove it, you know, like we would alcohol or drugs. We can't just eliminate it. It's got to be part of their life.
Joseph Cherokee thinks there are no easy answers, but it could involve limiting or better structuring internet use.
So you need to set boundaries and limits on when they can use social media, when they can play games, and just make it easier for them not to become addicted.
Would that involve having a daily time limit or having set blocks of when they can access the internet?
Yeah, look, I think each family has to sort out its own thing. And remember, it's a two-edged sword. You know, they need that social media to connect with their friends. And so we don't want to take that away from them. We just need to keep an eye on it.
Back in gaming land at Hugh Smith's house, the 13-year-old is learning ways of regulating time spent online and how it's affecting his behaviour.
Normally if it's nighttime, I'll probably realise it's going to be like dinner time soon or I'll go have a shower, just try and find other things to do.
That's Sydney teenager Hugh Smith ending the report from Gavin Coote. And that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Kim Landers.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.